It's good to see everyone out this morning. If you have your Bibles, you can turn to Exodus chapter 3. Exodus chapter 3 is where we'll be this morning, chapter 3 and 4. Have you ever felt incompetent at something? Have you ever felt inadequate at doing some task that was set before you? Right before the pandemic started, one of the last things I did was to take a ski trip with some of my friends. And you might think that sounds totally normal until you realize I've never been skiing before. I grew up in Alabama, not a lot of snow there. So I thought, well, this should be pretty easy, right? I mean, people do it on TV. I mean, if you can balance on a bicycle, it feels like you should be able to ski. Quickly figured out that's not true. It takes a lot of skill to do that well. Also discovered I did not have that skill. I spent most of the day on my side or, you know, prone on the mountain for one reason or another because it is hard to stop. I could stay upright, but when it came time to stop, that was the challenge. Usually solved that by falling down. So there are times you have to do things or choose to do things and you end up feeling incompetent. You end up feeling totally inadequate. And I think that's true spiritually, too, right? It's not just, you know, things like with your job or with your family, but it can also be true spiritually. Have you ever felt incompetent spiritually? Have you ever felt like you're not enough? Have you ever thought that there's no way that I could be an encouragement? There's no way that someone like me could show other people about Jesus? I've sinned so much. Have you ever felt like a spiritual failure? If you're being honest, I think most all of us have felt that way at some point. And if you felt that way, the good news is that God redeems and uses imperfect people. God uses imperfect people, but he doesn't only use them, he also redeems them for his service. If you look at the questions, the theme, I think, of these two chapters is that God uses imperfect people for his perfect purposes so that all will know that he alone is worthy of worship. I'll say that again. God uses imperfect people for his perfect purposes so that all will know that he alone is worthy of worship. I think that's what you learn from looking at the account of Moses in chapter 3 and 4 of Exodus. So, let's dive into the text. If you are in Exodus chapter 3, I'll read verse 1 for us. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Okay, time out. Let's stop there. We talked about this a bit last week, but just as a refresher, in what ways is Moses, from an earthly standpoint, maybe not the ideal deliverer for Israel? We come to hear him. He's here on the mountain. He's tending a flock. God is about to speak to him. You know the story. God is about to call him into his service to deliver Israel. But let's pause here for a moment. I think this is the first question I ask. In what ways is Moses, from an earthly standpoint, maybe not the guy that you would pick for this job? And I'll throw that open to you. Why is Moses not the guy you would pick? Yeah, you read pretty much all of my notes. You read my mind there. The shepherd, he's 80 years old. He's apparently not that articulate of a speaker, Greg said. He doesn't seem to have that much military expertise at this point in his life. I'll add one thought to that. How did Egyptians feel about shepherds?
Loathsome, yes, loathsome people. So this is not just blue-collar work, but to the eyes of the Egyptians, this would be like below whatever level is, you know, less socially acceptable. That's the way the Egyptians would have seen this. So that's the setting as God comes to Moses here in verse 1. Now, most of the class this morning, we'll be talking about the things that Moses got wrong. And there's a lot here in chapter 3 and 4 that he gets wrong. But here in the first 6 verses or so, there is one or two things that he gets right. So if you're looking at this account, verse 2, the angel of the Lord comes to him, appears to him in the burning bush. Moses turns and looks at it. Verse 3, verse 4, God calls out to him. Verse 5, God says, take your sandals off your feet. Can you see anything that Moses is doing here that's right? Is there anything, you know, honorable about his response here? Anything jump out at you? Yes. He says, here I am. He doesn't run away from God's call. Anything else jump out at you?
Notice that it says he covered his face because he was afraid to look at God. Perhaps a reflection of a sense of humility or just a reverence for the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Aaron says that he covered his face, a sign of humility, respect for the Lord. Moses seems to have some conception of the holiness and the all-powerful nature of God. So yes, he responds in reverence. I think that's one takeaway here. A second thing I'll throw out here is that Moses turns and looks at the burning bush. It specifically says that in verse 2 or 3, I think. Why? Think about the significance of that. I mean, on the surface you might think, well, it was a burning bush that wasn't consumed. I mean, who wouldn't take a look at that? But think about the symbolism here. Think about the symbolism of what's going on. The burning bush is a symbol that's pointing, a physical symbol that's pointing to a deeper spiritual reality. Now think about in our life. Think about how many people have a sign of a deeper spiritual reality. They see something like the creation, but they decide not to look any deeper into it. Think about all the people who can see physical signs or indications of God, but they don't approach and go nearer to investigate what kind of spiritual reality is this trying to point me to. But instead they walk away. Moses doesn't walk away. He sees a physical sign that's pointing to a deeper spiritual reality, and he draws near. He wants to know what is going on here. So we're going to talk a lot this morning about things that Moses got wrong, but to his credit, Moses gets some stuff right here at the beginning. He responds in reverence to God's call, and he approaches because he wants to know what's going on here spiritually. He wants to know the Lord. Thoughts on verses 1 through 6 before we keep going. Cool. Then verses 7 through 9. Verse 7 says, then the Lord says, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. Okay, if you were here last week, this should sound familiar, right? Exodus opens, like the very first part of chapter 1, with God talking about the history of Israel. Chapter 2 closes with God once again saying, I see their pain. So if you're keeping score, this is now 3 times in 3 chapters that God is reminding us, I see, I remember. Notice, Moses doesn't have to explain what's going on here. God doesn't come to him in the bush and say, like, hey, Moses, what's going on with Israel today? God knows. God is the one who's telling Moses what's happening. So I think this counters one of the most obvious objections to pain and to suffering, which is that if God hasn't done anything yet, he must not see it all. If God has not worked on my table, then he must not exist. And I think these verses are a counter to that. God had not yet, you know, delivered them from bondage, but he did see. He still was aware. So just the fact that you haven't seen anything yet, it doesn't mean that God isn't working. So that's what you see in verses 7 through 9. And now we get to Moses' response. How does Moses respond? if you did the questions, I categorized it in four main responses. Depending how you break it up, you could come up with a different number. But I'll throw it out to you first. Does anyone have any thoughts of what, if you could summarize, what are the three or four or five, what are the main responses that Moses makes to the call of God throughout chapter 3 and chapter 4? Clevin looks like he was going to raise his hand. Maybe he was just scratching. I'm not sure. Cool.
He says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh to bless him himself? Then he says,
yeah, the again, you read my mind. That was exactly what I had down. So there's, the way I counted at least, there's two in chapter 3, two in chapter 4. The first two in chapter 3, one he says he's inadequate, like I'm not the right guy for the job. Two, he says I'm ignorant, like what if the people come to say, like, who is the Lord? What do I say? Like, I don't know. So that was the second one. Three, he's insecure in chapter 4. He says, they won't listen to me if I bring the word of the Lord to them. And then the last one that Clavin mentioned, I'm inarticulate. I'm just not a good speaker. So there's four main responses, at least the way I count it, to Moses' call, response to God's call. So let's start off with the first response. Chapter 3, verse 11. Moses says back to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? Now, pause here. On the surface, I think this is a fair question. I think it's fair to say, like, who am I? Like, I'm someone who sinned. I'm imperfect. How can you use someone like me? I think it's a fair question for Moses to ask. Now, I'll put a pin there and say, I think you learn by looking through chapters 3 and chapters 4 that his motive really isn't an honest searching so much as trying to convince God to give it to someone else. So I think the key here is the motive behind. Like, why is he saying, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? Why is Moses raising this question in the first place? And I think the rest of chapter 3 and chapter 4 end up answering that for us. I'll also note here, this is a very different person than who we met at age 40. I think it's fair to say the wilderness has changed Moses. How do you think Moses has changed? I'll throw this one out to you. How does Moses here in chapter 3, and if you've read through chapter 4, how does the Moses you see there differ from the Moses that we met in chapter 2?
He's not as bold.
Sorry, could you say that one more time, Larry?
He is not as bold as he was.
Yeah, he's not as bold. Yep.
Well, I think, you know, like we talked last week, you know, when you look at the account in Acts 7, you know, after he had killed the Egyptian, you know, what was going through his mind at that time was that hopefully that he was hoping that his brethren would see that he would be able to deliver them and everything. So he saw himself as a deliverer 40 years earlier. Now he's not. And, you know, I think that speaks a lot to, like you said, he's a changed man. And a lot of it is stuff I think we can relate to. He had it in his mind how he could do this. It didn't work out. So now he's kind of lost as far as that goes. He's found this new life. He's happy there, apparently, and he's just ready just to stay there and say, hey, you know, I tried, it failed, find somebody else.
Yeah, that's a great point. To summarize what Tony said, Moses was ready to be a deliverer in chapter 2. In chapter 3, he's not so ready. So yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Look at God's response in verse 12. God says, I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you, that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain.
So, two things to notice here. One, notice he doesn't offer immediate proof. He doesn't immediately give Moses some amazing sign or miracle. What's the promise? Promise is in the future, right? Sometime in the future, your people will serve God on this mountain. And I find that encouraging because a lot of times when you think about the Old Testament, at least for me, it's easy to think, well, they got so many miracles. Like anytime they had a doubt, God would just, bang, do a miracle, and then they believe. That's not what's happening at the first part of chapter 3. God isn't doing an amazing miracle for Moses. He's just calling him in faith to trust, if you don't count the burning bush, I guess. that is kind of a big one. But what God is doing here in verse 12 is calling Moses just to have faith in his promises and to trust that in time he will work out all things for good. A second thought here is notice how God responds. He doesn't say, Moses, you're amazing. He doesn't say, Moses, you just got to get a little more self-confidence. You're really doing great, and I really need it. Who God talks about is himself. He talks about, he says, I will be with you, and I will give this sign, and who are you going to serve? You're going to serve God on this mountain. So God redirects Moses' gaze from himself back to the Lord. And I think that's a great way to deal with when you feel inadequate, when you feel like you're not good enough, when it feels like things aren't going right. Think about the response that God gave Moses. God said, focus back on me. Danny?
Okay, I think this is one of the most important lessons from just the first few chapters. And Tony said that Moses had intended to deliver the people, and then it just didn't work out. Whatever he had conceived in his mind, he had given up on. And I think a big lesson for us here today is to draw closer to God. We may have grandiose plans about how to serve or what we may do in our life, but when we get to the point where we empty ourselves of ourselves, when we're to the point where we're just focused upon doing our best one day at a time for God, that's when God can really use us. And that's when, if we pay attention, we realize it's not by us, but it's for God's glory, and it's by God's guidance in our lives that we can maybe
add just a small thing for God to this generation. Yeah, Danny said that sometimes it's when we're at our lowest point, it's when we've been emptied out of ourselves, it's when we can turn back to God most easily. That's what you see with Moses here, is that this is someone who has been emptied out of, you know, pride and self-centeredness, or at least, you know, more so than he was in chapter 2. Let's look at the second response. So that's the first response he makes. So then in verse 13, Moses says to God, okay, I hear that, but if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And by the way, this is where you start to learn that Moses just isn't asking a genuine question, but Moses actually has a trust problem here. He's asking the Lord of the universe, like, what do I tell my people about you? Like, how do I describe who God is to them? And notice God's response here. I actually don't want to read all this because it's really good. So verses 14 through 21, let's read those. God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, verse 15, say this to the people of Israel. The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Verse 16, go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, Jacob has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt. And I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. Verse 18, and they will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now, please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Verse 19, but I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. Verse 21, and I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and when you go, you shall not go empty. We'll stop there. What do you notice from God's response to Moses. Moses says in verse 13, I'm ignorant. I don't know what to say if they ask who God is. What do you learn from God's response? Any takeaways from verses 14 through 21? I guess you could have looked in verse 22 there. I don't know why I stopped. But from God's response, what does anything jump out at you there?
Multiple references to himself being the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is the God that they know, or they should know, precisely who it is who has sent Moses, and what he has already done for them should be the basis of their confidence that he will deliver them through Moses' leadership, as he is telling Moses to do.
Yeah, Aaron points out, he repeatedly says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. In other words, they should remember this God. Like, they should know who this God is. Anything else jump out at you?
When he's talking, he's talking about the power behind the name, so to speak. I don't know, probably a better way to phrase that. But not only I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that should call to mind the promises. And he speaks to those here because, okay, I'm going to take you back to the land that flows with milk and honey, to the land that he had promised them. So he's remembering his covenant. He doesn't specifically say those words, but it's referencing there. So he's bringing all these things back to mind, and it's like, hey, I've got the power to bring this out, but it all gets back to the point you were making earlier. I'm the one who has the power. It's not you, Moses. It's not even the people. I'm the one who has the power to do this. And just trust me.
Yeah, Tony said it's not only reminding them of his name, but it's also going deeper to remind them of the covenant, remind them of the promises, remind them, how did they get to this point? Absolutely. One thing that struck me is that God doesn't only answer Moses' question. He doesn't just define, no, here's God, here's the definition of my name. He actually talks about not just the stuff in the past, he talks about the future. Like, he gives Moses a play-by-play of here's exactly what's going to happen as I lead the people out of Egypt. So my takeaway here is that God gives graciously beyond anything you could even ask. Anything that we could even ask for spiritually, God gives that to us graciously. And I think that's what's happening here. Moses asks a simple question, and God goes beyond what he could have even asked. To give him faith. So that's the second thought. If you turn over to chapter 4 now, you'll see the third response that Moses makes. Moses says, basically, I'm insecure. They're not going to listen to me. Now, one thing that jumps out at me here is that if you were paying attention in chapter 3, this has already been answered. If the people are going to listen to Moses, like, that's a question that God has already talked about. He's already said, yes, they're going to listen to you. You're going to walk out of Egypt. You're going to worship me on this mountain. This is a question that's already been answered. Now, if you're like me, it's easy to criticize Moses here and say, Moses should have had more faith. God has already clearly spoken. But I think it's fair for us to ask ourselves, what are the areas that God has clearly spoken to us where we want more reassurance, or we have more questions, or maybe we don't fully believe? Where are the places that God has already spoken clearly to us that we're not entirely satisfied with? And for me, at least, that's a good question to ask. Maybe for you as well. Yeah.
And in a way, when you kind of go back to chapter 2, if there's a question that he's bringing up, this may be the most legit. When you think about what's the last thing, at least that we have record of, as far as his brethren and their reaction to him. Who are you that you're going to have to be a judge over us, and you're going to kill us like you did the Egyptians? So if that's the last thing in his mind, he's kind of thinking back on that. It's like, okay, here's how I left them. Why would they listen to me? In my mind, I can say, okay, there's a little bit of that's a fair question, but it all gets back to what God's trying to tell him. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
It's me, not you.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Tony makes the point that, you know, think about the way that Moses left Egypt. It's because his people didn't receive him. They rejected him. So yeah, this could obviously be a question that was on his mind. Will they listen this time to me? Other thoughts? First sign the Lord gives him in verse 2 is to take his staff and tell him to throw it on the ground. Think about what that staff represents to Moses. Think about what the staff would represent. We've already talked about how shepherds are despised among the Egyptians. I mean, to Moses, maybe I'm reading a little too much between the lines here, but to Moses, this could be a reminder of his greatest professional failure. He was supposed to be this great man in Pharaoh's palace, and then he went to kill the Egyptian, and then after all of that, he's out in the wilderness by himself tending sheep with just a staff in his hand. And God says, I can use that. Like, whatever you have, I can use it. You don't have the riches of Pharaoh's palace anymore. That's fine. You don't have the people of Israel physically with you. That's fine. You have a staff. Whatever you have, I can use that. And then what happens next? Verse 3, it becomes a serpent. Moses runs away. That's the biblical response to a snake. And then he catches it by the tail, and it becomes a staff again. He gives him two more signs. He puts his hand inside and out of his jacket. Becomes leprosy, not leprosy. Verse 9, turning water to blood, kind of foreshadowing what's going to happen in the Exodus, you know, which we'll talk about next week in the plagues. So a couple of quick thoughts here. Moses didn't end up getting some amazing, miraculous signs. But remember, this all started with God just giving him a simple promise that your people are going to worship here on this mountain. So a lot of times it's easy to think, I'm not getting a lot of amazing, miraculous signs, therefore I'm not important, or God doesn't care much about me. Well, that is, Moses only gets miraculous signs here because he's consistently questioning God. He's consistently asking, well, I'm not good enough. Are they going to listen to me? Who is the Lord? The only reason, you know, the reason Moses gets to see these three signs is to build faith in him. One thing that jumps out to me is that verse 9, when God says, if they will not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, the way I read this in verse 9, the they is referring to Israel. It's referring to the people that Moses is trying to convince that, yes, I am from God here. A lot of times we think about the plagues and all the signs of God as being meant to convict Egypt, like to judge Egypt, to expose their unbelief. And I think that's certainly true. They are. But I think Egypt is not the only nation with a belief problem. Egypt's not the only nation that needs to learn to trust God more. When you read Exodus, it's easy to think, Egypt are the bad guys, Israel are the good guys, and God is here to just liberate Israel. And, you know, there's something to that, but I think it misses one of the best points of the book. I think it misses how God is trying to build faith, not just in the Egyptians. He's trying to build faith in Israel and call them to himself as well. So those are some quick thoughts on Moses' third response. I'll stop there for comments. Any questions, thoughts on the third response that Moses makes there? Cool. So now we get to the fourth response. Verse 10. Moses says to the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. Then what does the Lord say? Verse 11, he says, I made your mouth. Who do you think made the mouth that you think is inadequate? Verse 12, therefore, go and I will be with your mouth. I will teach you what you shall speak. And here in verse 13, I think, is key to understanding the last two chapters. Moses eventually more or less throws up his hands and says, oh my Lord, please send someone else. And if you had to write a thesis statement for what Moses is thinking throughout these last two chapters, I think it's fair to say this is basically it. He does not feel adequate to go in the role that the Lord is calling him to. Now, to be fair to Moses, why would he not want to leave the mountain? Tony said earlier, it seems like he's found a happy home. Like, what are some legitimate reasons that he might not want to leave the mountain, to leave his home?
What are some
back in Egypt they were seeking to kill him.
That's a pretty good one. Tony says back in Egypt they were trying to kill him the last time he was there, so that's a good reason. Anything else? Yeah, he's been there for 40 years. This is home now. His family is there, the people he knows. He's already tried to deliver Israel, but that didn't work out. Like we mentioned earlier, he's pretty old now. I think he's 80 years old at this point. Most people are not starting up a new career at age 80. So there are a couple of legitimate reasons that he wouldn't want to leave the mountain. Now, none of these are wrong in themselves. It's not wrong to want to be near your family. It's not wrong to be nervous about moving at an advanced stage. Like, none of them are wrong in themselves. I think the problem is that Moses elevated all of these concerns above God's call on his life. He elevated his concerns about his safety, his concerns about whether the people would listen to him, whether they would even know the Lord. Like, all the doubts and all the fears that Moses had, he elevated above God's call on his life. So, so that's the fourth response he makes. Now, one of the questions I think I ask is that, notice how much of this conversation is recorded. The first two chapters, especially chapter one, covers about 400 years of history, more or less. But in these two chapters, it's one conversation. Chapter three and four is just one conversation. So, why do you think that is? Why do you think God went to so much trouble to preserve so much of one conversation when he can capture four centuries in just another chapter or two? What's the benefit of having this text?
It gives us a good look at where Moses is in his life right now. And just think about this. By the time we get to Exodus 33:11, God explains that he spoke to Moses in a different way, as a speaking to a friend. And we see how much Moses has grown. So if we really read these, especially the Old Testament, we read about characters, and not just for the sake of reading, but we read to try to figure out why did Moses have the relationship with God that he had? And what can I do to have a better relationship with God? What can I do to read these things, to seek to understand and grow nearer, closer to God? But we see where Moses is now, and we see how he's changed by the end of the book.
Yes, so Moses, this account gives us a great glimpse of Moses' spiritual journey, someone who's in the process of drawing closer to God. And especially when you look at this account in light of the end of his life, which we'll talk about next month, it can provide a great example of how you can grow in your faith. Great.
I think about the initial audience too, the initial readers of this, and this really documents the legitimacy of Moses' position as the deliverer of the people and the leader of this nation during his kind of formative years. And so it helped them to understand how it is that this man Moses got into the position and the role that he had for the that he took on for himself or was seeking his own glory in it. It gives them an understanding of how it is that he stepped into this role.
Yeah, that's actually a great segue. I have one or two main takeaways, I think, from this text. One, to springboard off what Greg was saying, God uses imperfect people for his perfect purposes. I mean, imagine who you would want to lead a movement like this by earthly wisdom. You would want someone who's young, who has a ton of energy, someone who's a charismatic speaker, someone who's plugged into the highest levels of power. Notice that Moses isn't any of those things. He's not young and energetic at this point. He's not a charismatic speaker. He's not someone who's plugged into the highest levels of power at this point. So I think one takeaway that we can get from looking at this is, when we read the rest of the account of the Exodus,
I don't think anyone should be confused that this is Moses doing. The people weren't delivered because Moses was super talented and just by force of will, he forced them out of Egypt. Like, this is God's doing. So if you think Moses' talent is the key to what made this deliverance work, you have the testimony of Moses himself here saying, I'm inadequate. I'm not good enough. So in one way, I think this highlights the power of God, that God can use someone who's imperfect, someone who has a lot of flaws, in order to bring about deliverance. So God uses imperfect people to still accomplish his perfect purposes. So that's one thing that I took away. Second thought, this Exodus is just a foreshadowing of a greater Exodus. Like, this deliverance of the people of Israel from physical slavery should point us to a greater spiritual deliverance from spiritual slavery. If you remember last week, we talked about the ways that Moses foreshadows Jesus. We talked about how Moses grew up where the king was decreeing that all male infants be killed, but a child is born anyway. Does that sound familiar? Well, similar to how Jesus came into the world. King Herod declared that all the male infants were going to be killed. Moses grows up in Egypt. Where did Jesus spend time in his youth? In Egypt. Moses was rejected by his own people, much like Jesus ultimately was rejected by his own people. Moses spends 40 years in the wilderness. Jesus spends 40 days in the wilderness. And then eventually Moses works as a shepherd among his people to lead them out of slavery. Jesus works as the good shepherd, the ultimate shepherd, to lead people out of spiritual slavery. And you might think, well, those are some nice comparisons, but that sounds like it's maybe stretching it a little bit. But I'm not sure. If you look actually at the account of the Transfiguration, Jesus is talking in Luke 9, and in verse 31, let me see here. In verse 39, Moses and Elijah appear. So Moses, notice, Moses is at the Transfiguration. And they appeared in glory and spoke of his departure. Now, that word departure, I'm not a Greek scholar, but people who are Greek scholars have noted the word departure there, the same word as Exodus. It's a leading out. So Jesus here is doing the ultimate Exodus, the ultimate leading out. He's going to lead his people out of slavery, just like Moses, who is present here on the Mount of Transfiguration, did in a much more limited physical sense for his people. So Jesus here is the ultimate deliverer. He's the ultimate fulfillment of what Moses is doing. Now, if there's anything that should be on your mind after chapters 3 through 4, is that we need a deliverer that's better than Moses. Moses can barely hold himself together. Moses cannot save himself even from his own sin. So we need a deliverer who's better than Moses. So I think the last question I ask, in what ways is Jesus the better Moses? How is Jesus the greater Moses? And to start with the obvious one, like, Jesus is God. Like, he was the incarnate Son of the Father. I think we know that. But let's drill a bit deeper. Like, in what ways is Jesus the ultimate deliverer, the ultimate rescuer for us? Any thoughts there?
So Moses led the people out of the physical bondage. Mm-hmm. Jesus will deliver us from the spiritual bondage.
Yeah, Moses delivered from a physical bondage, which is hard enough by itself, but Jesus did something harder. He led us out of spiritual bondage. Yeah? Any other thoughts? Yeah, Joe. Yeah, absolutely. Jesus didn't waver for unbelief. There's not a chapters 3 through 4 in Exodus where Jesus is asking these kind of questions of God in the New Testament. So yes, Jesus didn't waver in unbelief. He didn't say, send someone else instead of me. Other thoughts?
Moses was really resistant to the authority God was giving him. Jesus was very resolute.
Yeah, Moses was resistant to God's authority. Jesus was resolute. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Other thoughts? One thing that struck me is that Jesus doesn't just receive the words of God. Think about Moses' role. He's someone who's receiving the words of God, and then he's delivering it to Pharaoh. He's delivering it to Israel. He's delivering it, in some cases, to Aaron to say what to say. Moses received the words of God. Jesus didn't just receive the word of God. If you read John 1, Jesus is the word. Jesus is the word, and he came, and he dwelt among us. So the word was with us. The word wasn't just handed down, you know, on high on a mountain. The word came and became flesh. The word came and dwelt among us. So Jesus doesn't just receive the words of God and then pass them along to us, but Jesus is the word of God. That's one way in which I think Moses is greater. And then the second thought here is that Jesus is a mediator. We've kind of touched on this, but to reiterate, Jesus is a mediator who doesn't stumble. Moses stumbled a lot. If you look at the... We have two chapters here of him giving God reasons about why he can't be the deliverer. But if you look at the first part of the chapter, it starts off with him being in danger to even stand in God's presence. God says, take off your shoes. You're standing on holy ground. So this should produce kind of a weird contrast for you. On the one hand, he's in danger even to stand in the presence of God. And then for the next two chapters, he just gives God's reasons for why he can't follow the Lord's will. So why isn't Moses consumed immediately? Why isn't he, God just striking with lightning? Why does Moses survive? Why is he able to stand? And I think one of the keys here is looking at the first part of chapter 3. If you look at verse 2, who's present here? Verse 2 says, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. So think about, who is this angel? What is this angel doing? The angel is someone who speaks not only for God, but as God. So that should, you know, trigger some alarm bells in your head. Like, who can speak as God, like in the place of God? Not only that, he also accepts the worship of Moses. Now, we know that normal angels, if you read, say, Revelation, normal angels don't accept worship. When John in Revelation falls down to worship an angel, the angel says, get up, don't worship me. But there's nothing like that here in chapter 3. So what's going on? And the answer that I've heard that I think makes the most sense is that this angel is a pre-incarnate Christ. This angel is a pre-incarnate Christ who is there as a mediator between God and Moses. And I think that might explain how he's able to stand in the presence of a holy God and not be consumed. Now, this is not a hill that I'll die on. There's lots of controversy about who this angel is. But I think what is expressed here is there's the concept of a mediator. There's a concept of a mediator that's present here in chapter 3 that's keeping Moses from being consumed, even when he says things that he shouldn't. And that should be encouraging for us, that even when we stumble, when we fall short, we have a mediator. We have a mediator who can hold us fast. Moses isn't going to hold us fast. Moses can barely hold himself together. But Christ will be there for you, even when you fall, when you turn to him in faith. That's my takeaway from chapter 4. Other thoughts about that? Any comments? Yeah, Greg.
I don't get too hung up on the word angel, understanding it really means messenger. And there's a message that is to be delivered to Moses, and to your point, it's the word of God that is being delivered to Moses, and it's in this physical form that Moses can see and interact with. So I don't think of it as an angel in the sense that we read about, say, you know, Gabriel, as an individual separate, different from God. It's more of there's this physical manifestation who is delivering the message from God. And obviously speaks in the first person as God.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Greg says there are multiple uses of the word angel. It could just mean a messenger, someone who's sent by God to deliver a message. So, yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean the beings, for example, that you see in Revelation described. Yeah, Jason.
So in John 8:58, when Jesus says, "Before Abraham was, I am," we don't have to wonder what he meant by that, because they understood perfectly what he meant by that, and that's why they took up stones to stone him. So I do think that this is Jesus speaking. But as you said in your beginning, he's speaking before he was Jesus. So in the beginning was the Word, and in the first century the Word became flesh. So before the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, he appeared to Moses in the bush, and that is one of the reasons why he's superior to Moses. If he was before Abraham, then he was before Moses, and he appeared to Moses to call him to be this type and this shadow. And you've done a really good job this morning, you know, of outlining why Jesus, to quote the Hebrew writer, is far better than Moses, why this covenant is far better, why this Exodus is far better, because all of this is leading to the perfection that is Emmanuel, God with us.
Yeah, Jason makes the point that when Jesus says in John 8, "Before Abraham was, I am," the Pharisees were not confused about what he was saying. They knew exactly what he was trying to say there, which is that same thing as John 1. Like, in the beginning, the Word was there. Yeah. Other thoughts?
Sorry, I have one. When you were asking about the difference between Jesus and Moses, another that I thought about, I didn't hear mentioned, is that Moses was the deliverer for a certain people, whereas Jesus is the deliverer for all people, young, old, rich, poor, all ethnic groups, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another great point. I wish I'd made that myself. Yes, Jesus is the deliverer for all people, not just one group. Other thoughts? Cool. Well, Bill is making a run for the bell, so we will stop there, and we will pick up in Exodus chapter 5 next week. Thank you for your comments.